Theo Podcast. Ihr Podcast aus der Katholisch-Theologischen Fakultät der Uni Münster.
I'm here to introduce a lecture from Robert Yell entitled The Invisible Border, The Vanishing Line of Separation Between Church and State. This lecture was given at the annual meeting of the Institute for American Religious and Philosophical Thought, which took place in Berlin in June of 2023. And Professor Yell is professor of religious studies at Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich. He was educated at Harvard, Berkeley, and Chicago, and has held fellowships from the University of Toronto, the University of Illinois, NYU Law School, and the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. He is the author of Explaining Mantras, The Language of Disenchantment, Semiotics of Religion, and Sovereignty and the Sacred, in addition to several edited volumes and numerous articles and book chapters. And what this lecture is doing is excavating the legacy of Thomas Hobbes in terms of how one understands the essentially, I won't say invisible, certainly not invisible, but impossible to pin down border between religion and politics in public life. And what Professor Yell is doing is retracing a legacy of Hobbes in relation to John Locke when it comes to the received notion that secularism should mean a kind of common sense, self-evident separation of church and state. Now, what Yell does is he explains that for Hobbes, religion is a form of politics, and that there is no meaningful way that you can separate these two phenomena. The famous image of the Leviathan, the giant that bestrides the countryside, is a sense in which you have to have a unitary sense of public life, politics and religion very much included. But there's more to it than just this figure on the frontispiece of the Leviathan. There's also a sense in which the modern notion that a kind of public secular space can be somehow emptied of religious significance or disenchanted is something that was based on a prior Christian sense of public life and the function of the state, something that Yell is quite brilliant at tracing back to the 16th century with Richard Hooker's work. But what Yell does is he argues that when it comes to how we understand the relationship between church and state today, there's a real achievement that comes from living in a society in which political liberty exists, religious liberty exists, religious pluralism exists. But this is not something that is necessarily justifiable on any kind of categorical basis or a basis that comes from within Christian life itself. This is a political achievement and something that has to be constantly renegotiated in terms of pragmatic politics. And there's a real challenge that's invested and embedded in Yell's lecture when it comes to how we have to constantly rethink the relationship between church and state as a boundary or a border. And then there's even, in a more abstract way, a sense in which you can recognize that a border can be real even if you can't pin down where it is exactly. And with his expertise in law and legal histories, Yell is able to put these, frankly, perennial debates in context with a lot of contemporary examples from legal cases and different forms of political conflict. And in addition to being challenging, there's also, I think, a real sense of possibility that comes out of this lecture as well, not to mention a relevance to the relationship between religious and political borders, which forms the entire conference theme and the entire grant project that Professor Yale has contributed to.
In modern political thought, the passage from the state of nature to that of politics or of culture, properly speaking, is associated with the image of Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan, a colossus that straddles the countryside and looms over the precincts of the city. Hobbes famously described the state of nature as a war of all against all in which life is nasty, brutish, and short, thus invoking the mythical foundations of the state as having emerged out of a condition of violence and deprivation. This condition ends, according to Hobbes, when the people submit themselves to be governed according to a social contract that transfers all of the power of the sword to the ruler, against whom they abandon their right of resistance. Hobbes may have been drawing on some older theories of the emergence of polity, according to which groups organized themselves originally around symbols we would now call totems. In the first book of his Library of History, Diodorus of Sicily, whom Hobbes called perhaps the greatest antiquary who ever lived, described this primal scene among the Egyptians. So I have a long quote here from Diodorus. "Some advance some such reason as the following for their deification of animals. When men first seized living like beasts and gathered into groups, at the outset they kept devouring each other and warring amongst themselves, the more powerful ever prevailing over the weaker. But later those who were deficient in strength, taught by expediency, grouped together and took for the device upon their standard one of the animals which was later made sacred. Then, when those who were from time to time in fear flocked to the symbol, an organized body was formed, which was not to be despised by any who attacked it. So no longer a lone chess piece, but an entire board of players, now led by a king. And when everybody else did the same thing," Diodorus continues, "the whole people came to be divided into organized bodies, and in the case of each, the animal which had been responsible for its safety was accorded honors like those belonging to the gods." Diodorus offered this as one possible explanation for the origin of idolatry, including the worship of animals in ancient Egypt. And he actually explains that the same system continued from times of war into times of peace. So each of the districts in Egypt, called nomes, generally numbered at 42, would have one god. I would argue this is already the Westphalian principle several thousand years ago. Quius regio, eius religio. Hobbes appears to have taken some elements from this account, particularly as one of the beasts that came to be worshipped, namely the crocodile, was the original reference, as Theodore Beza argued, of either Leviathan or one of its synonyms, Tanim, in biblical Hebrew, an animal that in the Bible is identified with the Pharaoh who oppressed the Hebrews prior to the Exodus. I've already published a short version of this argument. I have a longer version that needs to be submitted. Pharaoh was worshipped as a god. In fact, John Selden, who was Hobbes's friend and colleague, argued that the word pharaoh just meant a king. And of course, for Hobbes, king was a good term. It was a euphemism, as was Leviathan. By embracing the emblem of Leviathan, Hobbes attempted to return us to a pagan understanding of religion, according to which religion was a political phenomenon and theology was subservient to reasons of state. As he affirmed, for the Gentiles or pagans, religion was a part of their policy. Jean-Jacques Rousseau followed Hobbes explicitly in arguing for a civil religion. Both of these thinkers of the radical Enlightenment blamed the biblical tradition for having separated religion from politics in a manner that was ultimately detrimental to the security of the state. Such formulas as civil religion, political theology, and even sacred kingship, the last of which is making a surprising comeback these days, highlight the challenge in distinguishing the religious from the political. I spent years thinking about this, and I still haven't quite got it straight, but I hope to soon. These formulas call into question the common definition of secularism as having enforced a separation between church and state. It is long past time that we revisit the history of these debates. The literature on secularism has exploded in recent years, especially since the publication of Charles Taylor's 2007 work, A Secular Age. Unfortunately, the proliferation of this debate and its migration to different scholarly subfields has not always afforded coherence. Secularism is now used in any number of ways, for example, to define a particular affect or habitus, which is supposed to be somehow characteristic of modernity. Despite this, there is still recognizable a core meaning of the term secularism that centers on the separation of church and state or of politics from religion. Thomas Jefferson's famous image of a wall of separation, as well as the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment, which prohibits an establishment of religion while providing for a free exercise of religion, namely one not subject to constraint by governmental authorities, manifest this idea. Similar guarantees have been enshrined in the constitutions of almost all liberal democracies, including in the German Grundgesetz of 1949. The promise of the secular then depends upon our further ability to demarcate the religious from the political. Secularism as a governing ideal of our political systems, if not an entirely objective description of reality, requires that such a distinction be possible both logically and practically speaking. It therefore represents a challenge to the foundations of secular liberalism that, as has been noted increasingly in recent decades, not only do we lack any logical universal definition of religion, but also the idea of a separation of religion from politics itself appears indebted to aspects of Christian tradition. If we cannot demarcate the category of religion, then it follows automatically that neither have we any idea where the secular begins and ends. That would make the modern liberal doctrine of secularism incoherent at its core. Further, if secularism remains indebted to a particular religious tradition and its attendant assumptions, this would signal the lack of universal applicability of this category to other cultures and historical periods, arguments that have been made, for example, with respect to contemporary Indian secularism. To put it bluntly, if secularism emerged from Christianity, then the secular cannot be non-religious as it has usually been presented. This calls into question what Hans Blumenberg defended, namely the independence or legitimacy of our modern age. The 2011 case of Laozi v. Italy in the European Court of Human Rights cited portions of the decisions of lower courts, which maintained that secularism had emerged from Christian tradition and that a crucifix displayed on the wall of a classroom in the Veneto was not incompatible with the principle of religious neutrality. This evidences that the idea that secularism has Christian roots has become a commonplace. It also raises the question of whether the cross, even when not so prominently displayed, has nonetheless left its imprint on our mentality. The German legal historian Georg Jelinek argued as far back as 1895 that freedom of religion emerged not from the anti-religious ideals of the French Enlightenment, but rather from dissenting Protestant groups in Britain and her colonies. Even before Jelinek, the Scottish theologian James Stuart Candlish noted the theological basis of the 17th century New England preacher Roger Williams's defense of toleration in the Bloody Tenet. Recently, more attention has been paid to Williams by evangelical Protestants in America who suggest that religious liberty ought to work to the advantage rather than the detriment of religion. Others less interested in defending the prerogatives of religion have questioned the thesis that toleration had roots in Christianity. To my mind, however, contemporary histories of the rise of toleration, such as that by Nicholas P. Miller, although that was now about 10 years ago, have only reinforced Jelinek's thesis. Although this debate continues, let me share my conviction that the idea of a separation of church and state had its genesis indisputably in certain theological ideas, as Zeev Falk argued already four decades ago. Long quote from Falk here. A few remarks must be made on the idea of the separation between law and religion. Separation, or rather secularization, he says, may be defined as the emancipation of humanity from the religious dimension in general and from a clerical rule in particular. It must be understood that this has been a particular phenomenon in the history of Christianity, and he's writing from a Jewish perspective, and must not necessarily play the same role in other religions, such as Judaism, Islam, or mystical systems. Although many Christian churches resisted secularization, it is implied in the Christian dichotomy between God and Caesar, Civitas Dei and Civitas Terrena, as well as between spirit and body. Paul's spiritualization of biblical law, drawn to its logical conclusion, means irrelevance of law for salvation, which in turn calls for secularization of law, thus Falk. Although we normally think of the secular as both non-religious and potentially universal, We therefore have to confront the paradox that secularism emerged, at least in part, out of Christianity. One of the key texts of liberalism, John Locke's 1689 letter concerning toleration, began by claiming that the true hallmark of Christianity in any age has been toleration. If we recall the history of the Middle Ages when a hegemonic church enforced religious conformity and suppressed heresy, we may experience some incredulity at this claim. I hope it's okay to say that here. Aus Herkunft bin ich halb katholisch, halb evangelisch. Okay. I'm speaking, I suppose, more as a Protestant here, perforce. However, Locke was not unique in this view. Within less than a decade, Humphrey Prideaux, the Dean of Norwich, explained that toleration was the doctrine of true Christianity, and not of various impostures, which for him included Roman Catholicism as well as Judaism and Mohammedanism, or Islam. According to Prideaux, the chief characteristic of an imposture was that it failed to separate religion from politics. The idea that religion, or at least the true religion, meaning a certain Protestant interpretation of the Gospels, was apolitical, was influenced by a particular interpretation of older theological doctrines. These included the idea that there are two kingdoms, as Falk noted, which was anticipated in the New Testament and codified by Pope Gelasius I at the end of the 5th century. Another source for this idea was the badly neglected prophetic interpretation of Genesis 49:10, regarding which I shall say a bit more later. Note that this does not mean that religion ever was apolitical, only that it was thought ideally to be so. Locke's argument for toleration, which proved far more influential than Williams's, depended no less obviously on a theological basis. Locke defended a modified version of separation, according to which there is and must be a distinction between the church or churches and the commonwealth or state. There should be a clear division of labor in a state between magistrate and minister, representatives respectively of the civil and ecclesiastical powers. In some of the most strident passages in his letter, Locke insists upon this form of separation. Quote, "The church itself is a thing absolutely separate and distinct from the commonwealth. The boundaries on both sides are fixed and immovable. He jumbles heaven and earth together, the things most remote and opposite, who mixes these societies which are in their original end, business, and in everything, perfectly distinct and infinitely different from each other," end quote. It is easy to recognize that Locke is restating a version of the two kingdoms doctrine, albeit in a modified and, from the church's perspective, perhaps a truncated form. While defending the division of labor between church and state, which are to work on souls and bodies respectively, Locke also redefined religion as an individual and inward persuasion, making the church a voluntary association and extending the franchise on religion beyond a monolithic national Church of England so as to make way for various independent congregations and modes of belief and practice. This was a clear determination in favor of the mode of church organization normally called independency as opposed to episcopacy or Presbyterianism. Locke's formula for toleration won out, partly because it was persuasive in its rhetoric and partly because it gave voice to a developing status quo that in England emerged after the Glorious Revolution at the end of the 17th century. The struggle between Catholics and Protestants for control of the English crown ended, as nobody wished to revisit the conflict between radical Puritans, Presbyterians, and the Anglican Church that had contributed to the English Civil War. A pragmatic accommodation of religious differences gradually solidified. Eventually, Catholics too were tolerated. From a purely logical or philosophical perspective, however, Locke's defense of a version of the two kingdoms doctrine left much to be desired. As has already been noted, other philosophers who contributed to laying the foundations of the modern constitution, including Hobbes, rejected utterly the idea of separation, and with this, the understanding of religion as apolitical. A predecessor of both Hobbes and Locke, the 16th century Bishop Richard Hooker, called the Judicious Hooker, in his masterpiece, The Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity, defended the established Church of England against its most fervent Puritan detractors. Hooker's argument for a state church controlled by the monarch depended partly on the fact that church and state were already, to a significant extent, coextensive, because, quote, "there is not any man of the Church of England, but the same man is also a member of the Commonwealth, nor any man a member of the Commonwealth, which is not also of the Church of England," end quote. Although overlapping in their membership, actually identical in their membership, church and commonwealth were two different corporations with distinct functions, according to Hooker. However, while agreeing that the walls of separation between these two must forever be upheld, Hooker saw nothing that would forbid the English sovereign from heading both the church and the commonwealth. This affirmed the principle announced earlier at Augsburg and again at Westphalia and Münster of quius regio, eius religio, the religion of the realm should be that of its ruler. Hooker's use of the phrase wall of separation may come as a bit of surprise for those Americans who attribute this phrase either to Thomas Jefferson or to Roger Williams, who used the metaphor of the garden in the wilderness. There's an excellent book on that. This underscores that the modern doctrine of separation is not at all a product of non- or anti-religious theorists. The idea itself emerged from Christian theology with the transformation of the medieval doctrine of the two kingdoms into something more closely resembling the modern liberal view that church and state should be separate. It is important to recognize the tangled history and legacy of such views, and this is exactly what I'm trying to remind us all of today. First of all, Hooker was arguing against a clean separation between church and state. He attributed the insistence on separation to the opponents of an established church under the control of the monarch, that is, to the church's radical Puritan detractors. Hooker acknowledged that there existed a formal separation between church and state as corporations or divisions within a single nation or people, yet denied that this meant these bodies were truly distinct, and therefore they could have one head, right? One body with two heads is a monstrosity. As Pope Boniface VIII already pointed out in Unum Sanctum, there's a long history of these debates. Noting that both these corporations, were precisely congruent in their membership, he insisted they could have the same head, and so from then until now, with a few hiccups, as reaffirmed also for King Charles, and a few beheadings, reaffirmed also for King Charles III, the monarch of England is head of both state and church, irrespective of any qualities that might otherwise be regarded as rendering a person unfit for such a role. This upheld the Westphalian principle. Although we heard Gary point out the shortcomings of Westphalian sovereignty yesterday, in defense of this principle is the argument that territorially bound sovereignty is, at least in theory and certainly in Hobbes's theory, susceptible to the democratic franchise and the social contract. It is as difficult to imagine a trans-territorial sovereign as it is to imagine a universal plebiscite. Hooker's argument for the convergence of church and state invoked the metaphor of the triangle, which unites three sides and three angles in one geometric figure. He almost certainly took this figure from Trinitarian theology, which held that the three persons of the Trinity are ultimately one and the same. Thus, Hooker's argument rested on a sort of legal fiction, a version of the idea of the body politic as a corporation that, as F.W. Maitland and Ernst Kantorovich have shown, originated in Christian ecclesiology and Trinitarian theology. As Kantorovich detailed in his masterpiece, The King's Two Bodies, the original form of the corporation was the church, united in the mystical body of Christ as mediated through the Eucharist, which later served as a model for the state or commonwealth. Emerging in the latter part of the Middle Ages, the idea of the Catholic Church, headed by the papacy as enjoying absolute power and perpetual existence, was applied to the king, who had two bodies, one natural and mortal, the other official, corporate, and immortal. This idea proved tremendously influential, having survived into the contemporary era, and even stimulated the modern American theory of the business corporation as a legal person with capacity and agency, and also with religious rights, as in the Hobby Lobby case, which I might get to. Hooker's argument that one person having a single natural body might be a member or officer in the distinct corporations of church and state, and therefore have, as it were, two or more bodies, echoed similar arguments regarding the persons of the Holy Trinity. As Maitland recognized, Hobbes was drawing on such ideas where he represented the Leviathan of the state as a giant person consisting of many lesser bodies. Yet Hobbes was no mere passive conduit for the transmission of such ideas from medieval to modern times. Instead, he radicalized Hooker's argument that because the membership of the English church and state were identical, these two bodies could scarcely, if at all, be distinguished. Despite their solid ecclesiological foundations, Hooker's arguments did not resolve conclusively the relationship between church and state in England, not least because these arguments could be used to reach different ends. While Locke cited Hooker approvingly in his second treatise, His defense in the letter of the separation of church and state was most probably directed against Hobbes, who had developed Hooker's argument in a manner that collapsed church into state. In a key passage of Ecclesiology from chapter 39 of Leviathan, I've actually got it up here, Hobbes argued, quote, church, when not taken for a house, that's a laugh line, actually. He's laughing at us. When not taken for a house, signifieth the same that ecclesia signified in the Grecian commonwealth, that is to say, a congregation or an assembly of citizens called forth to hear the magistrate speak unto them. According to this sense, I define a church to be a company of men professing Christian religion, united in the person of one sovereign at whose command they ought to assemble and without whose authority they ought not to assemble. And therefore a church is the same with a civil commonwealth. Temporal and spiritual government are but two words brought into the world to make men see double and mistake their true sovereign. There is therefore no other government in this life, neither of state nor religion, but temporal, nor teaching of any doctrine lawful to any subject which the governor, both of the state and of the religion, forbiddeth to be taught. And that governor must be one, or else there must needs follow faction and civil war in the commonwealth, between the church and the state, between the spiritualists and the temporalists, between the Democrats and Republicans. No, he didn't say that. Between the sword of justice and the shield of faith, and which is more in every Christian man's own breast, between the Christian and the man. In this passage is contained a distillation of Hobbes's argument for a unitary sovereign. In order to avoid the possibility of conflict, such as had contributed to the outbreak of the English Civil War. Already in chapter 29, Hobbes caustically compared the loyalty simultaneously to church and state as causing a division in each individual akin to mental illness or demonic possession. As Jeffrey Collins has demonstrated, Hobbes's views were fundamentally motivated by ecclesiological considerations. In arguing for the identity between church and commonwealth, Hobbes borrowed the same logic that informed Hooker's defense of an established church in the preceding century, namely, that the very persons who were members or limbs of the body politic were, at least in a Christian commonwealth, also at the same time members of the church. Hobbes added to this the argument that the head of both institutions must be the same person in order to avoid conflict and dissension. To do otherwise would negate the unity of the polity itself. Logically speaking, then, it made no sense to speak of church and state as distinct entities. With such arguments, Hobbes attacked at its root more than 1,000 years of Christian theology that had distinguished church and state as two overlapping and complementary authorities. He also drew upon such predecessors as the martyred William Tyndale, whose translation of the Greek word ecclesia as congregation rather than church called into question the hegemony of the established church with a capital C, right? Germans still capitalize all nouns, right? Which is really quite bizarre. The English used to do that, but it stopped at some point several centuries ago. I don't know if there's a history of that that's ever been written. Called into question the hegemony of the established church and paved the way for Hobbes's nominalist reduction of the church to the status of a legal corporation subject to state control. Aiming to end the contestation between the two kingdoms, Hobbes attempted to unify these two bodies under a single head. Contestation between the two kingdoms had troubled Latin Christendom for centuries. During the height of the Middle Ages, the papacy had tried to resolve this contest in its own favor. In 1302, Boniface the Ace Unum Sanctum, already referred to, argued for the subordination of the temporal to the spiritual power by arguing for a union under the umbrella of the church or papacy. He argued that one body with two heads would be a monstrosity. In 1520, Luther's address to the German nobles defended the prerogatives of the temporal authorities and argued that the church was one body, rejecting the division between clergy and laity as one of the walls that defended the power of the papacy. In England, the Reformation began with Henry VIII's 1534 Act of Supremacy, which asserted his control over the Church of England. In keeping with such Reformation precedents, Hobbes argued for a single church united under the temporal monarch. Hobbes is often thought of, or called, an Erastian, meaning a proponent of the view that the state should control the church. In reality, he was far more radical than this. Rather than merely affirming a form of establishment on pragmatic grounds, Hobbes went further, implying and in some cases directly stating that religion itself was a phantasm or figment of the imagination. For such reasons, he has often been recognized as an atheist. His conclusions followed logically from a rigorously consistent materialism, nominalism, and skepticism. Hobbes invoked arguments both from skepticism and from the new science of optics, on which he wrote, to argue that religion was a form of double vision. He applied the skeptical problem of the criterion, the problem of how we may know whether we are waking or dreaming, to the distinction between religion and politics. It is only in the past 40 years or so that the study of religion has dared to venture onto this territory again, and somehow has not rediscovered Hobbes when doing so. Within the boundaries of a given state, extending to the very borders of its territory, Hobbes insisted that there can be only one authority in matters both civil and ecclesiastical. He expressed a clear preference for monarchy while allowing that an assembly such as Parliament could hold the sovereignty. Claims by clergymen of a de jure divino, or a divine right, authority in religious matters, meaning that they were granted these powers directly by God, rather than derivatively from the king, had contributed to political unrest in England for many decades, extending to the English Civil War, and the beheading of King Charles I in 1649, a mere 2 years before Leviathan was published. Hobbes wrote directly in response to these events and with the purpose of preventing them from recurring. So the parallels between 17th century England and contemporary America appear disturbingly striking. Even while interpreting religious schism as a cover for political dissent, Hobbes highlighted the dangers of such religious differences when these are politicized. And here we have an engraving from Wenceslaus Haller, who was once thought to be a candidate as the designer of the frontispiece. Actually, Hobbes had a direct role in all of this, as the scholars concede. Now most people would say it was Abraham Bos following Horst Bredekamp's pioneering work. I'm still not entirely convinced by Bredekamp's argument, but you see in any case here a depiction of a background in Egypt, which was actually, as I've discovered, taken from George Sandys's earlier travelogue to Egypt. The only new element is this two-headed snake, which represents civil war. And this, of course, is in the immediate context of the English Civil War. On the right, you have the title page from the first complete edition of the Geneva Bible authored by the Puritan dissidents who fled to Geneva during the preceding century. And it included illustrations, only one of which is repeated. That is to say, the illustration of the flight from Egypt. And as we know, what comes immediately after this is the destruction of the Egyptian army. An event that in the Bible, in such texts as Isaiah 59 and Psalm 74, was associated with God's destruction of the sea monster, Leviathan. So Hobbes may have been thinking about and responding to, in a form of critique, this appropriation of biblical imagery on the part of the Genevan dissenters, which had fomented so distinctly dissent and political unrest in England. And this explains partly why he tried to rehabilitate the name Leviathan, which in the tradition, and it's unavoidable to reach this conclusion, Pace Sir Noel Malcolm at All Souls College, Leviathan was the Pharaoh of Egypt. And Hobbes read the Exodus as a political revolution, thinly allegorized, right, in the same way in which his mentor, Francis Bacon, read stories about the battles between gods and monsters in pagan mythology as allegories of political revolutions. Whereas Hooker was content to allow a formal legal separation between the corporations of church and state, Hobbes deployed nominalist and skeptical arguments to call into question the very existence of the church itself. Of course, he did not do this overtly. This was not possible in the mid-17th century. It is necessary to read Hobbes esoterically or between the lines, as Leo Strauss recognized earlier. Hooker, as we heard, borrowed the geometrical figure of the triangle as an illustration of the mode of relation between church and state. With church and state as its two sides and a shared base in the commoners, the nation would remain stable. The triangular figure was a commonplace of Christology and Trinitarian theology, which argued similarly that, although God, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost are distinct persons, they are also united, a single substance, as the Council of Nicaea determined. Just as any two sides of a triangle emerge from or converge on the same point, they are both separate and inextricably linked. As Quentin Skinner has noted regarding the frontispiece of Hobbes's work, the two weapons of Leviathan that you see at the top of the frontispiece, sword of state and ecclesiastical crozier, the staff of authority, indicate a triangle, the borders or corners of which extend beyond the boundary of the frontispiece. Skinner suggests that this triangle may be a reference to the Holy Trinity. This suggestion is reinforced when we consider that Hobbes borrowed arguments from Hooker to defend the idea of an established church. It appears that he may have followed Hooker's use of the triangle as well to express the manner of relation between church and state. There are other likely sources for Hobbes's use of the triangle. One is Jean Bodin, but Hooker appears the most likely, to a dead certainty, I would say. Despite taking as his point of departure such unimpeachably orthodox authorities, however, Hobbes went far beyond orthodoxy in breaking down the wall of separation between church and state. The two sides of the triangle representing the civil and ecclesiastical authorities, as we see, converge at the apex, which is the hidden author of action and motion from which all things emerge and to which they return. Hobbes was by no means calling merely for an Erastian state-controlled church. He was anticipating the collapse of the church into the state and the monopoly of the state church in the civil religion of the Leviathan. Locke's impassioned defense of the necessity of separating church and state seems to have been motivated by Hobbes's collapse of the two. Recent painstaking historical research by Jeffrey Collins, who has approved this argument already, I can say I'm very happy to hear, and Felix Waldman, has demonstrated convincingly that despite his silence and occasional disavowals, Locke was an avid and careful reader of Hobbes. In those days, it was a bad thing to be a Hobbesian, so you didn't want to give away that you were. Even absent the new archival evidence excavated by Waldman, it should have been clear that Locke's ecclesiology was intended as a direct rebuttal of Hobbes. You just need to put these two passages side by side, passages from Leviathan and from Locke's letter concerning toleration. But it's nice to have the historians weigh in on this. At this juncture, I must confess that my heart and mind are pulled in separate directions. My heart is with Locke, especially on those points at which he diverged from Hobbes' settlement of the church-state question. Locke defended toleration or the freedom to dissent in belief and practice from the established church, whereas Hobbes insisted on outward religious conformity because he regarded dissent as a fundamentally political act, subversive of the state. Locke also defended against Hobbes the right to overthrow a tyrant. My head is with Hobbes not only because he was the more systematic philosopher, but also because he was perspicuous enough to anticipate the conclusion that many have subsequently reached, namely that there is, in fact, no principled and consistent criterion by which we might clearly demarcate religious functions from political ones. And without such a criterion, we are left unable to distinguish and separate the functions of church and state. Both Hobbes and Locke represent important tendencies within what we call secularism. On the one hand, Hobbes's call for a monolithic nation-state predicted much more accurately the central trajectory of modernity, according to which the state has assumed control over violence, or what Max Weber called a monopoly on the legitimate use of force within a given territory. Again, Westphalian. Legal positivists who take Hobbes as their ancestor tell us that law is positive only when it is backed up by coercive authority and sanction or punishment. This means that only state law can be positive. This is also a direct implication of Locke's argument for toleration in matters of religion, which turn the churches into voluntary associations. Indeed, the church or churches have become legal corporations under the aegis of the state, with a status similar to that of business corporations. This consequence of secularism was diagnosed in the late 19th century by Otto von Guericke in Germany in Das Deutsche Genossenschaftsrecht, as well as by Frederick William Maitland and John Neville Figgis in England, the last of whom in particular lamented the church's reduction in status. This required the collapse of the older model of the three estates, which is another likely reference of Hobbes's triangle. Paul Friedland traced the beheading of the Corpus Mysticum in France not to the decapitation of Louis says, but rather to the moment in June 1789 when the National Assembly in France was declared sovereign. Whereas the previous system subordinated the will of individuals to the estates, the clergy, the nobility, and the third estate, the emergence of a body consisting of members elected democratically, but unfettered by any popular mandate that would predetermine their votes, meant that each member became a direct representative of the French nation. The change of composition in the National Assembly resolved, at least for legislative purposes, one dimension of the problem of representation. This event was a clear illustration of the modern development in which the twin monads of individual citizen and monolithic state now exist in a direct relationship conditioned by voluntarism, echoes of the covenant or social contract that Professor Pally was mentioning yesterday. As von Guericke put it, quote, the sovereignty of the state and the sovereignty of the individual were steadily on their way towards becoming the two central axioms from which all theories of social structure would proceed, end quote. The Hobbesian version of this grounded the direct relationship between citizen and sovereign on the social contract, an idea that Hobbes is often credited with inventing, but he uses the words covenant and contract interchangeably and synonymously, and it's obvious that he's referring to the biblical tradition of covenant or berit, which was also a commonplace during the entire period of Christian Hebraism. As the state has extended its reach to nearly all aspects of life, we have all become subject progressively to a uniform legal code. One of the most distinctive aspects of what we call secularism is its universality, that is, its borderlessness, if I can translate into the terms that we're using here. Thus, the special privileges for ministers or benefit of clergy, as it used to be called in English, went away, as well as other forms of discriminatory treatment. The idea of equal treatment under law is deeply entwined with what we think of as modernity. In India, the fact that there still exist separate systems of personal law for Hindus, Muslims, Christians, and other religious groups is seen, conversely, as a sign of the imperfect secularization of the Indian state. At the same time, in conformity with Locke's argument for religious toleration, what we call freedom of religious belief and expression, or FORB for short, carves out a zone of relative freedom from state power in certain matters that are private or in which the conscience is deemed especially sensitive. FORB is often found in combination with other freedoms regarded as closely related, including those of speech, assembly, association, and conscientious objection. In such documents as the German Basic Law of 1949, worldviews or Weltanschauungen are afforded the same protection as religion. This suggests that what is really being defended is matters of conscience and expression more broadly, or even a certain zone of privacy or intimacy rather than religion per se. Indeed, especially in the United States, freedom of expression is allowed within very broad limits and with few exceptions other than those related to the prohibition of fraud or defamation and the maintenance of public order. Freedom of association is not limited to religious associations. Indeed, the term religion in most of these human rights documents is scarcely defined, but is used in a common sense manner or is taken to possess a self-evident meaning. Although not news, such facts bear repeating because they have important consequences for our understanding of the boundary between church and state. Against the Leviathan of Hobbes's monolithic church state, and Winnie Sullivan, her last book has the title Church State Corporation, right? We're merging all of those things now. Locke defended an exemption for individual freedom of religious belief and expression. He seems to have been a believing Christian, albeit a Socinian or anti-Trinitarian, and as previously noted, he defended a version of the old Two Kingdoms doctrine in vestigial form. What Locke did not manage to do, what arguably, this is a point of debate, no one has managed up until now, is to define with precision any criterion by which we might distinguish the boundary between religion and politics or the provinces of the minister and the magistrate, respectively. An example is when Locke argues that if I can hold a feast in my backyard and slaughter an animal pursuant thereto, as an American, I imagine a pig roast or barbecue, then my neighbor, Melibaeus, should be able to do the same in the service of his god and call it a sacrifice. After all, the external actions are the same. If the civil authorities have no objection to a feast, they should also have no objection to calling this a sacrifice or thusia and offering a prayer as an accompaniment or even a condiment. Locke's hypothetical is convincing, but only as an argument that we ought not single out religious activities for discrimination. This was exactly the holding of the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1993 Hialeah case, in which Santeria chicken slaughter was singled out for prohibition. What happens, though, when we have a general prohibition that is rational and does not discriminate against those actions carried out in the name of religion? Locke admits the legality of such a measure. As Justice Antonin Scalia argued in the 1990 case of Smith v. Employment Division, which I think was referred to at least the holding yesterday, a neutral law of general application cannot be challenged in the name of freedom of religion. But this has led to vigorous protests and reactions from the religious community. The Smith case involved the use of the hallucinogen peyote by members of a Native American group. Peyote use was prohibited to all. The plaintiffs claimed an exemption on the grounds that their use of peyote was sacramental. They lost their case. We might regard drug use as an obvious case for the magistrate. But general rules have been used to prohibit longstanding and fundamental religious practices. In Belgium today, slaughtering animals without first stunning them has been prohibited as a form of cruelty. Because kosher and halal slaughter required dispatching an animal by slitting its throat and draining its blood, these methods of butchery are now illegal in Belgium. Should we deny that animal slaughter is a matter for the magistrate or create an exemption from the law on the grounds that such religious practices as kosher and halal slaughter are of long standing and are integral to Judaism and Islam? I guess it's the John's example of the 2,000-year-old Christian appropriation and supersessionism that we're dealing with here. Such questions are difficult, if not impossible, to answer. In any case, there are political questions. In some jurisdictions, infant circumcision has been labeled medically unnecessary as well as, obviously, non-consensual, echoing debates in earlier centuries concerning what Anabaptists, Vita Teufel, called pedobaptism. Locke argued that the magistrate can command the washing of infants for the purpose of curing or preventing disease, but should not force a baptism upon anyone. Today, it is common practice to vaccinate newborn infants against such diseases as hepatitis B before they leave the hospital. Yet there continue to be religious objections to such practices, as well as for adult vaccination. Right? This suffices to illustrate that the line between religious and civil matters has not become any clearer since Locke's day. When Locke wrote at the end of the 17th century, almost everybody in England was a Protestant or at least a Christian. That meant they shared a set of understandings or assumptions concerning which matters were religious. Locke's examples of sacrifice and baptism were two such. Indeed, by the mid-17th century, some Protestant theologians such as Ralph Cudworth and Joseph Mead had concluded that sacrifice originated in a shared meal as part of natural religion. This interpretation extended Luther's argument that the Mass was in no sense a sacrifice and that the Eucharist, or Abendmahl, originated when Christians brought food and drink to church and shared them. Such theological interpretations coincided with Locke's argument that a sacrifice and a feast were similar, an argument that appears to reach for an ecumenical golden mean between Catholics and Protestants by allowing each their own beliefs. Controversies over religious belief and practice had contributed to defining what counted as religious, and the long tradition of a shared scripture and liturgy, together with a systematization of canon law versus civil law, meant that Locke's argument that church and commonwealth were or could be kept distinct made sense in its context. It was pragmatically effective. Hobbes's attempt to force a unification of religion with politics, which is also subterranean and very much against the grain of contemporary thinking in his day, appealed to no such set of shared understandings, but was instead expressed in terms that suggested his disdain for Christianity. Yet his arguments were too powerful to be ignored. When Locke defended the separation of church and state by claiming that to force their unification meant to, quote, jumble heaven and earth together, he invoked a theological metaphor. In 1660s England, Protestants argued that the division of labor between magistrate and minister reflected what was found in the Bible. For example, in the relationship between Moses and his brother Aaron, the progenitor of the Israelite priesthood, or between the first king in Israel, Saul, and the prophet Samuel who anointed him. These arguments made the separation of church and state either divinely revealed or a reflection of the natural order. In either case, something not to be questioned. One problem with such arguments is that they are based on revelation rather than on reason. Another example is the prophetic reading of Genesis 49:10, which I mentioned earlier, which read in part, quote, "The scepter shall not depart Judah till Shiloh cometh," read since the time of Eusebius as a prophecy of the coming of the Messiah. This verse was quoted often in the 17th century discourses we call Christian Hebraism, which contributed to the foundations of contemporary secularism. Jesus's or Shiloh's coming supposedly coincided with the loss by the Jews of national sovereignty or the scepter, an event identified by several commentators with the destruction of the Second Temple by the Romans in 70 AD and the expulsion of the Jews from Palestine. Not merely an historical event, this was taken as the fulfillment of the gospel revelation, which had transformed religion into something fundamentally distinct from politics. To reunite religion with politics was to go against the gospel itself. Such ideas appear to have influenced Locke's argument for a separation of church and state, and they were invoked by Humphrey Prideaux a few years later when, following Locke, he condemned political religions as impostures. Arguments from Christian theology cannot be dispositive in a secular polity, and so it is that we find in actual practice, when confronted with the problem of how to draw the line between religion and politics, courts of law have failed to do so convincingly. Winifred Fowler Sullivan and others have demonstrated concretely the impossibility of religious freedom, because the state and its agents, including judges, are determining the line between good or protected religion and bad religion, which may be prohibited. They are, in effect, doing theology or distinguishing orthodoxy from heresy, thereby violating the ban against an establishment of religion enshrined in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. This astute observation is only reinforced by the further fact that the line between church and state is shifting and has been drawn differently under different jurisdictions according to varying understandings of what it might mean to be secular. Secularism does not define a fixed doctrine, but rather, as Hossein Ali Agrama has referred to it, a problem space characterized by the need to constantly police the boundary between the religious and the secular. What I have been arguing is that this is, of course, also an inherited problem, one that is, or was, or should have been clear from the very beginnings of the liberal constitution. Despite the passage of time and an enormous amount of jurisprudential attention, the problem has not been resolved. If anything, recent years have revealed once again the magnitude of our confusion. You know, I had, as a former lawyer, a discussion of cases from the EU and from India and also from the US, and because I digressed from time to time, I'm running over my time, and I want certainly to reserve time for discussion if there is any. So I think I'm going to wrap this up, my point being sufficiently clear that there is no way that the courts have yet been able to articulate clearly that would allow us to draw the line where politics ends and religion begins, or vice versa. And since I think that is probably the part of my argument that is most familiar to people in the audience, I can happily dispense with it. So, skipping over the discussion of all those cases, I'll move to my conclusion. For a long time, encouraged by a Lockean understanding of religion as a private and individual matter, what has often been termed the first freedom, that of religious belief, expression, and association, enabled the growth and flourishing of a robust and diverse civil society in liberal democracies. This flourishing of not entirely novel is probably unprecedented in degree, although we must admit that ancient India was already massively pluralist and polytheist. So, as civil rights have expanded, they have acquired further momentum so that gradually the amount of freedom in society has increased inexorably. I'm sounding like Steven Pinker. I'm not sure I'm happy with this kind of optimist. I'm not a natural optimist. Okay. In proportion to our toleration for difference and extension of the franchise to groups that were long oppressed, religious minorities, women, and those with different sexual orientations. Having initially, perhaps as far back as the Exodus, served as an impetus to the birth of freedom, religion appears now to serve, in some cases, as an obstacle to the onward progress of liberty. It may be necessary, finally, to acknowledge that we do not know where to draw the line between church and state, and to abandon the fruitless task of attempting to expand freedom in the name of religion. In the end, these questions are political, and we either reach a pragmatic consensus or we fail to do so. The virtues of belonging to a church are well known. Just yesterday, I read that churchgoers statistically enjoy better physical and mental health. I don't know if that's true or not. I'd like to believe it, but then I would have to go to church more often. What worries me is the problem that Hobbes pointed out in the middle of the 17th century, namely that membership in multiple political associations with conflicting commitments can, in some cases, lead to violence. And of course, I'm hoping that this is not true and that maybe Trump supporters can be reasoned with and placated, perhaps pacified by lower gas prices and better opportunities for manufacturing jobs in the heartland. I fear, however, that we run the risk of repeating the historical example of the radical Puritans who fomented the English Civil War. I don't think we're nearly at that point yet. So I guess I'll stay on the side of hopefulness and optimism for now, in the spirit in which Professor Pally so brilliantly argued yesterday. But it's worth keeping in mind at least these historical parallels, which are, I think, once we take them fully into consideration, quite disturbing and provoking. So we've fallen into a kind of passive acceptance and naturalization of this definition of secularism as separation of church and state, which was never true, never true. This is characteristic of traditional religious polities in which there is actually an operative division of labor between authorities we would identify as religious and political, respectively. This is what Rodney Needham in 1980 called dual sovereignty, and he begins with the Christian example of the kings of England and the archbishops of Canterbury. But this is precisely not what is characteristic about the secular. The secular represents a collapse of that older idea. And the sign of this collapse is, of course, Hobbes's Leviathan. It's the monopolization of power by the nation state.